Okay, then good morning to everyone, or rather, hello. It's 2 p.m. For some of us, it has been a quite long night, and so it's still morning for us. Thank you again for coming. I see we still have quite a couple of empty seats. This is mostly the other speakers or other participants who are somewhere outside discussing other issues. We don't care about them. Maybe they know some of this stuff. Anyway, once again, Paul Davis is going to speak the third time during this conference and the last time. But he's still available afterwards, so if you have some urgent questions to ask him, there is still room until this fall tomorrow. Okay, Paul will tell about, I think, looks like what pitfalls he has come across during the development of Ardor, his main project, his hard disk recording system. So, Paul, here is your audience. Hello. Go ahead.
This was originally called 10 Things You May Not Have Thought About. I couldn't find 10. So then I wrote this list out, and I realized as I was falling asleep at 1:30 last night that in fact there's two things in this list that I'm not going to talk about either. So actually several things in this list I think that I'm not going to talk about. So the next hour of your life is even more Spartan than this list would tend to suggest. As Frank indicated, initially when I was invited to come and speak here, there was some discussion of whether I should talk specifically about Ardor. And I suggested that I thought that might not be all that useful. The project exists, the source code exists. Once you get used to my programming style, you know, there's a lot you can find out from reading it. And I thought it might be more useful to try to take a more general approach and talk a little bit about some of the central issues that have come up during its creation, sort of abstracting them away from Ardor and talking about how they might impact on other projects. I also wanted to do this because there's still a remarkable number of audio software projects that start for Linux that are being started clearly without people understanding some of the issues that they're going to face in version 2 or even in version 1. And so I'm going to try to cover a few, and as I say, unfortunately, even this list is longer than it really will be. The first thing I want to talk about is real-time programming, which I know for several people in this room are already familiar with it, but I think it's really a critical element to successful Linux audio work, at least within the domain of, I guess, what we're loosely calling professional audio as opposed to consumer stuff. The central issue that you have when you're writing audio software is that something has got to keep up with the flow of data to and from the audio interface. And if you don't, you get clicks or you lose data, depending on whether we're talking about playback or recording or both. Now, in terms of keeping up, we have a few things that could keep up. We could have the kernel, which is really the device driver, keep up by buffering things between the hardware and user space. And at the right time, it moves things back and forth between those buffers. We can have the user space, which is the application that is under consideration, buffering data and doing I/O on some periodic basis. The last option is that we can force the application to do I/O whenever it's possible and in whatever amount is possible right there and then. There's not really any buffering, per se. This third option is different than the first two. And this third option is, of course, the one that Jack forces on applications. Now, if we do kernel buffering, we're buffering for a start, which means we're increasing latency. And also, although it's a bit limited in the sense of a policy, it's also installing policy in a kernel space. Now, this is not as bad as this phrase is used sometimes. I mean, ALSA provides mechanisms for buffering or not buffering. You can use mmap or you can use read or write. But if you use read or write and you use buffers in the driver, you're using the kernel to handle something that arguably you shouldn't. And I think it is arguable. If you use user space buffering, you also increase latency. And certainly in my experience, it's tricky to actually get it exactly correct. I don't mean tricky in the sense it takes you months, but actually getting it to work just right can be a few days worth of work to try to figure out exactly how it should happen. If you do I/O on demand, suddenly you have to use real-time programming, because when we mean on-demand, we mean on-demand. You have to do I/O right now. And it's also less resilient to artifacts caused by scheduling delays, processor load, PCI bus problems, stuff like that. So each one of these solutions has its problems. But as everybody here probably knows, I'm a big fan of the real-time approach. And I think it's great because it really helps with low latency. And although I agree with Frank van der Pol that, you know, you don't want to go too far down the low latency path, it's a good goal to try to go as low as you can so that you have plenty of headroom. It's low latency because you write data as close as possible as to when you'll be able to hear it, and you read it as soon as it's available. It's worth noting there are tricks you can play with Nmap and some other clock source, like the real-time clock. Certainly on old ISA cards, which can actually transfer samples one sample at a time between the audio interface and the computer. There's some really fun tricks you can play with this. I know both myself and another guy in, I think in Sweden, not sure where, have both done individual sample processing loops with this kind of trick, where you process one sample at a time. But you can't do it on PCI bus interfaces, and you can't do it with all audio interfaces at all. So it's really a trick that we don't want to use. But we do want to use real-time programming, and we do have this question, why do so many apps not do it? Why are so many audio applications written to not use real-time programming? I think the reasons are not hard to figure out. Most of them don't have low latency requirements. Most of them are things that are playing WAV files. They're doing what I somewhat prejudicially call consumer audio. They tend to buffer large amounts of data, which is a corollary of their lack of low latency requirements. Some of them don't have any real-time parameter control. If you're not ever going to modify the signal as it flows through the program, you don't really care about latency. If you can't modify the gain of the volume of the signal, then who cares how long it takes for the effect to show up? Because there is no effect. It doesn't matter. However, having said that, lots of programs, even like XMMS, many people notice that when you run it with the default settings on many systems, there's a lag. You modify the EQ controls, and you have to wait a second sometimes to actually hear the results. Half a second, something like that. Using real-time programming always ends up being a trade-off. You end up with a program that's much more sensitive to problems in the OS, but at the same time, it becomes more responsive to users. And whether one of those is a bigger positive than the other one is a negative depends a great deal on what the goals of the application are. When you run a regular thread on Linux, it's running in essentially a timeshare mode, where the operating system is going to try to schedule threads in a way that tries to find a balance between those that are I/O bound, that is, they're waiting on disk I/O or keyboard I/O or some other kind of I/O, and those that are compute bound, which is the ones that just want to suck up computer CPU cycles. And it's really trying to find a nice balance between those so that your interactive programs that you're sitting down typing into or speaking to or doing whatever get a chance to run at the same time as trying to give a reasonable amount of cycles to those that just need cycles. But this isn't acceptable for real-time programming. For real-time programming, a thread that is ready to run, that is in our case a thread that is about to do audio I/O, has to run right now. It's not good enough to say it'll run soon or we'll give it a certain amount of time. It has to run right now, and it has to run for as long as it needs to run for. So the regular scheduling tends to delay threads and cause problems with timing because, as I said, it has to run right now. So what are the things that tend to delay them? Well, one thing is another thread running. Obviously, if there's something else running, you have to wait for it to finish. You could be waiting for unrequested disk I/O, i.e. page fault handling, for those that are not into the details of computer science. A page fault happens when your program tries to access some memory that is not currently resident in memory, and the hardware says, oops, there's a problem here, and essentially sends an interrupt to the processor and says, there was a page fault, can you please make sure that you get the memory in, loaded in, and it will carry on. Your program didn't ask to do disk I.O., but we have to do it anyway. It could also be delayed by actually waiting for disk I.O. that it did ask for. You want to read some more stuff from a sound file, you want to read something from a configuration file, you want to read something you need to display something on the screen with. And disk I.O. takes time, it involves locking things in the kernel, it involves all kinds of stuff that that can cause a delay. You could also just be stuck in the kernel waiting for some condition to become true. You might be waiting for a lock in the kernel that's protecting some data structure present in the kernel. You might be waiting for a lock or a kernel semaphore that does some synchronization between different parts of the kernel. You might also get stuck, not so much because you're ready to run and you can't, but because the device that's going to make you ready to run, in the situation we're talking about here, it's an audio interface normally, the device that makes you ready to run has sent an interrupt, but the processor has blocked them. Now, the operating system is not handling them for some number of microseconds. And so even though your thread should be running right now, it's not, because the operating system doesn't even know the interrupt has come in. And this particular block is quite a tricky issue. So how do we avoid these sorts of delays when we're writing software? Well, the most obvious way is to just get your thread to use real-time scheduling, to put it into a different scheduling class so that the kernel, rather than saying, which one of these threads do I think I should pick? Let's see, this guy's done a lot of I.O. This guy's using a lot of cycles. He's ready to run. He's not ready to run. We've run him 100 times and him 60 times. I think we'll pick him. Instead, SCED-FIFO says, if this is the highest priority thread that is ready to run and it's SCED-FIFO, then we just run it. There's no other choice. We don't care how often it's run. We don't care how many cycles it's run. We don't care what it's doing. If it can run and there's no other higher priority thread, it runs. Not only that, it runs until it either blocks, meaning typically that it does some kind of disk I.O. or reads from the keyboard or something, or it yields the processor. I've never actually seen any software that calls SCED yield, but there is a system call which says, I don't know what to do. Maybe you can have the processor back. Or alternatively, an even higher priority thread that's also in SCED-FIFO, the SCED-FIFO class, becomes runnable. If until one of those conditions comes true, your thread will run. Now, this has a problem, which is that you can completely lock up the system. If it gets stuck in a while loop, the kernel won't do anything. It just says, well, you know, this is a thread that should be running. I'm just going to keep running it. And it doesn't have any way. This mechanism is not designed to be intelligent. It's not designed to come in and say, well, I know he's scared FIFO, but we gave him 5 minutes of runtime and he used it all. The point is, it's runnable, it's scared FIFO, it runs. So that's the first thing that we can do. Next thing is, we need to try to avoid page faults. These occur, as I said, whenever you access a memory address that's not in physical RAM. You have to do disk I.O. to bring it from the disk into RAM. We'd like to avoid this, and the simplest way is a fabulous system called mlockall, which basically says all the memory that my program has currently allocated and everything that I allocate in the future, I would like to be locked in physical RAM. I don't want it moved out to disk under any circumstances whatsoever. This is great because now there's no page faults. There's no way we'll ever have a page of our memory moved out onto disk and then have to wait for it to come back in again. The problem is, that is a little subtle, is that on Linux, as in many other Unix systems, allocating memory does not mean that there's actually any physical RAM that corresponds to it. You can allocate huge quantities of memory from the kernel, and the kernel will happily tell you, sure, that's fine, and only when you actually start to use it will it actually start figuring out which pieces of physical memory should I use to correspond to this data. And so if you haven't touched the pages, at this point you haven't done anything. You call mlockall, you appear to have locked everything down, but the data that you want, there's no actual physical RAM allocation. And it can be important to make sure that you do touch it, the physical RAM is allocated, and at that point you've been through the whole process of making sure everything is pinned in memory. This is one of the reasons, by the way, why Jack, when a client first connects to Jack, Jack actually executes the process callback, I think, 8 times, just because. The idea is that if we call the client's process function, it will touch all the code memory, and presumably some significant chunk of data memory that the process callback will really use. And by the time we actually start running it for real, it's all in physical RAM and it's ready to go. Disk I/O, how do we avoid that? It's very simple, you just don't do it from a real-time thread. The IRQ blocking is really a problem. And I've been describing to a few people some debugging that I did last year on Jack that was trying to get to the bottom of this. It's really hard. The problem is that sometimes the kernel, for perfectly good reasons, decides to block all interrupts. And it doesn't do it for that long, at least not by most people's standards, but it does block them completely. And if you block them for too long, one of two things can happen. We either completely miss the deadline that the audio interface has, or we don't miss it, but there's so little time left before the next interrupt that we just can't do what we need to do. The problem is in terms of trying to track down why the kernel does this, you need to be able to trace everywhere in the kernel that blocks and unblocks interrupts. There are some really obvious places that are known to do this. When you switch virtual consoles on Linux, the interrupts get blocked for up to a half a second, which is insane, but it's the way, at least in 2.4, that's the way that works. But in order to try to go through and figure out where these blockages are, where the block and unblock things are, you have to be able to, first of all, recompile the whole kernel so that you modify the lock and unlock instructions so that you can actually see, well, they locked it here and unlocked it here. How long did that take and why did it do it? That assumes there's always a matching pair, that the kernel always locks and unlocks. But at least on Intel hardware, the hardware blocks interrupts too. If you suffer a page fault, then the CPU itself blocks interrupts. And under those circumstances, all the kernel does is unblocks them. And so now when you create a nice trace showing all the places where we blocked them and unblocked them, we get these spurious places where we only unblock, which makes it extremely difficult to go through and figure out where is it in the kernel that this happened. So at this point in time, we can't do a great deal about this other than just say, you know, it happens. We need to configure our systems as carefully as possible. If there are good kernel patches or fixes or redesigns that come out that address this, we need to use them. Andrew Morton has claimed 500 microseconds worst case blocking time for the 2.5 series kernel. It's not bad, but it's pathetic compared to a real-time operating system. And it's, as I mentioned yesterday, 40% of the time, well, 35% of the time we have for handling 64 frames. The other problem that we have with real-time programming are the security issues. You can't use SCED-FIFO or MLOCALL unless you have root permission or you own cap resource. I think it's cap resource. Somebody else. And you can't get cap resource unless you first of all have a capabilities enabled kernel and some system to grant it to you. And you can't get root permission unless you are root or you have something like sudo floating around in your system or you use the set UID bit on your application. None of these are good solutions. You know, it's absurd to have to tell people, oh, by the way, you need to become root in order to run this sample playback engine. On the other hand, it's also not very nice to have to tell people, oh, you can't use that kernel to do sample playback. It doesn't work because it doesn't have capabilities enabled. So we're at the point right now where this is basically ugly. You know, things like Planet Karma do provide low latency and capability enabled kernels. I don't think Red Hat are shipping their kernels with capabilities enabled. Hopefully, one of the distributions will start doing this at some point because we need something to usher in a new era here in which it's possible to access these resources without such so many hoops to jump through. And many people say, well, what about the security implications of this? What about, I mean, having to be root? I mean, isn't that terrible? Well, look, the point is, you're about to run an application which can completely lock up your machine if it chooses to. It'll probably load arbitrary shared objects and run them, and it will also lock all of its memory into physical RAM. Basically, you're about to run a program that can do anything it wants to your system, okay? And it will only run if it can do those things. And so the fact you have to be root in order to start it is just the icing on the cake. However, this, of course, doesn't really fit in with the security model that Linux has in general, in which, you know, security is taken at least reasonably seriously. And I don't know whether it's going to come from another type of kernel patch or something, but there are times when I feel that it will be really great to have a kernel which just basically says, you know, SCED-FIFO and mlockall don't need this kind of access. You know, they're available to any user any time that they want them. And you obviously wouldn't install a kernel like that on a server or on a time-sharing machine. But if you're sitting at home and you have a machine that you use for doing music, you might choose to either specifically boot into that kernel for doing music or even to run it all the time. If somebody can get in and get root permission to run these programs, somebody being able to get in and get SCED-FIFO doesn't really change the equation at all. So that would be an interesting kernel patch to have, I think, one that would make these things available to any old program. We also have problems on Linux that the kernel isn't good enough. As I mentioned, the interrupts get blocked for significant fractions at a time that we have available. Conditional schedule, which is the call that originally Ingo Molnar introduced and now Andrew Morton's patches for 2.4 put in, is not present in all the places that it should be. So we still don't get the lowest latency that we can do, even with Andrew's patches. There's evidence that SCED-FIFO tasks, although I just said earlier that whenever you have a SCED-FIFO thread that can run, it runs, there's some evidence that that does not happen. It's rare, and it's not clear why, but there's some evidence that, it, at least in 2.4, that it doesn't happen. We don't know whether 2.5 or 2.6 is better yet. I don't know. There are a few people on the mailing list who have used it, but we've had very few reports so far as to how well it works. It may be that it's going to need a series of low latency patches and scheduling patches too to be usable for the kinds of things we want to do. But right now, the belief is that it's... my impression is it's probably about as good as 2.4 with the low latency patches and the preemption patch, but not quite as good. I forget to say before my talks, if people want to ask questions or butt in with comments at any point, feel free to do so. Let's move on to another topic. Arda is a hard disk recorder, and that's certainly how it started life. And it turned out to be relatively easy to write a hard disk recorder for Linux. The reason Arda still is not available in binary release is that a hard disk recorder is almost useless. I realized after recording a 24-track session with it that I can't do anything with it. I can't edit it. All I can do is play it back. I now spent the last 2 years trying to fix that. But so in theory, you know, the hard disk side of things, buffering stuff to disk and saving it to disk and so on, was really solved early on. But actually, it wasn't, because it turns out that as the editing aspects of Arda have evolved, there have been many subtle issues that have come up with the buffering strategies that have involved having to go back and not so much completely revise, but certainly tune the way that we handle disk buffering. Why do we have to do disk buffering at all? Many applications just write to and from the disk whenever they want to. My own favorite example of this, which I was very sad to find out about, is SND, Bill Schottstadt's fabulous sound editor. You know, he's right in the middle of processing audio to be played back to the disk, and he decides to go get the next sample from the disk. His code assumes it's cheap, and if you're working on a stereo sound file, it probably is. You fire up sound with a 12-channel sound file, and you rapidly find it just clicks and pops and does all everything else because it's doing all this disk I.O. right in the middle of the audio processing, or audio I.O. And sound is not alone in this. There are many other programs that work in this way. And unfortunately, virtually all of the canonical examples of how to do things on Linux tend to do things this way as well. Even the most recent, hopefully we'll fix it next week, but even the Jack Capture client, although it makes an attempt to do this in a different thread, it still doesn't do it in the right way. So there really haven't been a good set of examples as to how to approach this problem. Wait for the big red fluffy thing.
An audience question?
Yes. You talk a lot about how applications do things and how the applications need to be changed in order to work properly under Linux. But I think it's perfectly okay for a sound file editor like SND to do its reads and writes in the middle of the audio processing if that's what the sound file editor wants to do. Because the sound file editor doesn't need low latency. But I think, on the other hand, what's wrong with it is that the kernel doesn't know that this data is going to be required very, very soon. And instead of fixing all the applications that are already written for a very, very useful API, like the POSIX API, I think the strategy should be to fix the kernel to the degree that you can say, here you have an application like SND, which will read and write in order to do audio playback. And thus we could prioritize those disk I.O. events that occur for this application. And then we wouldn't need to fix all the applications that are already written, and instead could just fix the kernel once and everything would be nice.
I don't think you can fix it once and make everything right. If you go into sound and you jump to a marker and play immediately, and you have a 12-channel sound file or a 24-channel sound file, it will take you... In fact, it gets worse if you use a large buffer size in some respects, because it will actually take you close to a second to actually read the data from the disk. There's no way of notifying the kernel ahead of time because you just jump to the marker and then hit play. It actually takes a large amount of time to bring that data off the disk and into memory. Even if you can tell the kernel about it a half second ahead of time, which is hard in many cases, there's an awful lot of circumstances where it isn't enough to deal with the fact that you are moving a huge amount of data from the disk. The reason why these applications work with the design they do now is because they don't do much disk I.O. They're mostly stereo sound file editors, or they're even working on a mono file, and therefore it works. But if you scale it up, I think what you realize is the problem is not in scheduling. It's not in trying to tell the kernel, can you please get this into memory soon because I'm going to need it. The problem is that it takes a long time to move this much data off the disk and into memory. And unless you know about it a long way ahead of time, telling the kernel about it won't help. The people I know who've done work on modifications to operating system file systems and so forth, where you do this sort of pre-reading, I mean, Oracle has been very, very interested in seeing work done on this. And I have a couple of friends at OSU who've done work with them, actually for Linux even. And you look at the sort of problems they're dealing with where they do that, they know, minutes, hours ahead of time, that we're going to need this data. And so the operating system can work at leisure to make sure you have it. The problem with this audio stuff is lots of the time you have effectively no time at all. And yet you've still got, 8 megabytes of stuff you need to get off the disk and into RAM really quickly. And the disk drives just aren't quick enough to do that. So I think, although I agree with you that there are kernel modifications that would help with this sometimes, I don't think there's any kernel modifications that will get rid of the need to discard the assumption that disk I.O. is cheap. And we have lots of programs that assume that disk I.O. is cheap because they only work with stereo sound files, where it is cheap.
Yeah, the problem is that...
Okay. Yeah, so maybe we should move on and we can come back and talk about this at the end, or even the end of this section. Yeah. Oh, yes, I'll repeat the question, okay. Here's the mic.
Okay, just a clarification. You talk about threads. Is that a Unix process or a lightweight process?
Both. Do you want me to clarify the difference between them?
No. I'm just not sure when you say thread what you mean. Lightweight process or Unix process.
In Linux, there really isn't that much of a difference. The way that a new process is created and the way that a new thread is created is actually identical. What's different is which resources are shared with the parent. Well, when you create a thread, I'm using the term thread specifically here, you share the address space of the parent. When you create a new process, you do not share the address space of the parent. But because it's all created copy on write, there's almost no difference in the amount of time it takes to create them. The difference starts to happen when the new process starts running. So in fact, the difference between a thread and a process in Linux is pretty small. When I'm talking here specifically, I guess I'm really talking about user space threads that in the implementation that we have, well, I guess we have a new one from IBM now, but the implementation that we're using now, user space threads map one-to-one onto kernel threads, which are almost identical to processes except that they share an address space.
Paul, we have one more short comment here.
Sure.
Just trying to keep that short. I think you're both right with having these demands on the system. But I think actually what you can do, because that you're right, if you keep the kernel easy because it has other tasks to do, not only audio stuff, just push it all into kernel would be a bad idea, I think. Would be a good idea just to have this middleware thingy. I'm looking forward for Jack or something like this to handle all these demands, actually, because you can, like, also do this security stuff in the Jack level, because you can install like a daemon that's running root properties and can do all this configuration stuff and handle the demands, and the application just cares about how to give it to Jack and configure the middleware just to push it down to the hardware stuff.
Right. Well, I think Jack is evolving to try to do as much of that as we can. I mean, Fernando's work with capabilities, for example, makes that possible, that you can have this, you know, single entity that then hands all the permissions out to everybody. But you need to have capabilities to do that. If you just have root access, that doesn't work because you can't give root to somebody else. So it gets tricky. But I agree with you that trying to get as much of this into libraries or, you know, standard systems would be good. So in addition to the fact that disk seek times are long, operating systems can also screw up disk I.O. If you've got other disk I.O. going on, it gets even slower to get the stuff that you want. And the net result of this is that, as we've all heard, you get clicks, you miss data when you're recording it. So we have two questions to ask. If we can't read and write as part of the audio processing thread, which I fervently believe, when can we do it? And how do we buffer the data until we read it or write it? Well, Arda has been through a couple of designs. The very early design, which I think I talked about 3 years ago somewhere, used multiple buffers. And that turned out to be problematic, although initially it seemed to be a very obvious solution. And then we've moved on to ring buffers. The multiple buffer design looked something like this. We had a list of free buffers that was hanging off to this side. The audio thread would go grab a buffer from the free list down here. It would stuff audio into it from wherever it was coming from. Then it would stick it in a list of pending buffers. The disk I.O. thread, a separate thread, would pull it off the list, write it to disk, and then stuff it back in the free list. And this seemed okay. But it seemed nice because we don't need locks on the buffers. Each buffer is only being operated on by a single thread. We only need locks on the lists, and we only access them when we have to pull a buffer off. And, you know, the whole thing just seemed to have, you know, it felt like it had a number of nice qualities to it. But as happens so often, I was wrong. Was I wrong because I didn't go all the way down to the bottom? Yes. The real problem with this system that emerges only after you start really moving along is when you start to do VariSpeed. Because originally you size these buffers so that they're a nice multiple of the block size that you're processing. If you're dealing with 1,024 frames each time, you make these a multiple of 1,024, and then when you're in the middle of doing audio I/O, you don't have to go get another buffer. But when you start to do VariSpeed, it turns out the number of frames you read or write into the buffer starts to vary. You write more, you write less, or actually, I guess this is only true for playback. For capture, you'd always write the same number, but for playback, with I guess is what VariSpeed is, you're pulling different numbers out, and you end up finding that right in the middle of the processing, you need to go get the next buffer. And this means you now have to go take the lock on the list, and you have to pull the stuff off the list, and you have to switch buffer pointers, you have to dispatch the other buffer to wherever it's going to go, you end up actually having to take two locks, and the whole thing starts to get quite messy quite rapidly. So we move over to the tried and trusted lock-free ring buffer, much discussed on LAD and other places. Well, you have a single buffer, which is divided into two chunks by two pointers. There's a write pointer and a read pointer. This section in here, after the read pointer and before the write pointer, is readable. And this section after the write pointer, before the read pointer, is writable. This type of buffer situation can be used without locks. And it can be used without locks because there is only one thread that modifies the write pointer and only one thread that modifies the read pointer. That's a limitation. There are some situations where you'd actually want multiple threads to write into the buffer, and you can't do that with this. Because there's only one thread writing each one doesn't mean that the other thread can't read the wrong value. For instance, the thread that's reading might go check where the write pointer is to decide how long this section is, and it might get an old value because this is in the middle of being updated. But that's okay. The pointers only move in one direction, and every time that they move up, which means if you read the old value, all you do is you underestimate how much is readable. The read thread in this case will think that we can only read to here, maybe we could actually read to here. Likewise with the read pointer. So you don't need any locks. You have a single buffer, and you can move through it at any speed that you want. There's never a buffer switch. You're doing various speed. You zip through here, or you go really slowly all the way through, and nobody cares. There's no reason to have to worry about the buffer boundaries or anything else. And so various speed works very naturally with this setup. However, there is one problem that comes from this. I don't think I put it on the next slide. The problem with this design is that it's something I've come across recently. I was talking about this at breakfast, but now I have a picture. Nowhere in the buffer is there a record of what position in the buffer corresponds to what transport position. Imagine that that this actually corresponds to, frame 1,000. There's no way for us to find that out. We're reading this data, and this is frame 1,000, and this is frame 2,000 or something. Pardon me for not using powers of two. We don't know that. So if we refill this buffer, or if we have a copy of this buffer, and we want to actually to make a copy of the buffer and refill it, for example, we've just edited the data that this represents, and we need to get a new copy, there's no way for us to know what the read pointer was actually pointing to. And there's no way for us to know what the write pointer is really pointing to. Now, what happens with this is, I'm explaining it much too simply, when you sit down, you initially think you can do it, and you go in and implement it, and then it turns out that actually it's a bit more complicated than that. And then you decide that you can't do it, and then you wake up one morning and think you can, because you've realized how to do it, and you do that, and you realize it's even more complicated than you thought. And the end result is that you still have this basic problem, no matter how you cut it, that you don't actually really know what's in the buffer at any particular point in time. It's very hard to set up a system where you know exactly what this sample right here corresponds to. And that makes it hard to devise a system for this where you, for instance, use one buffer most of the time, but every so often you refill another buffer and then you switch pointers to use the buffers. This is something that I'd really love to be able to do in Ardour. Those of you who've used programs like Ableton Live and other programs will know that they can actually, you can edit the playlist when you're working in the editor, and there's no click, there's no interruption. They'll just carry on playing the modification without any interruption. Ardour can't do that yet. There's a very small click, sometimes there isn't any, but we end up having to take locks and do all kinds of things to actually reload this buffer. And it's quite problematic, and I'd love to find a solution that lets us avoid that. Scheduling disk I.O. Yeah.
You said the ring buffers can be used without any locks.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still true on the multiprocessing system?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
How much disk I.O. should we do? It turns out from careful, precise, accurate scientific measurements that you want to do very big chunks whenever possible. And big chunks, the optimum, for, at least for the X2 file system, seems to be about 256 KB. So if you can organize your writes to happen in chunks like that, you get much more efficient flow to disk. If you write in chunks of 16 KB, it's dramatically slower than with 256. Disk I.O. stalls, which is a phenomenon I don't fully understand, but see every day, can delay the arrival of disk material by up to a second. You can have a predicted time for when you think when you think you'll get the data, but it can actually take a second longer, which means you're going to have a pretty big buffer to deal with this. Ardour typically uses 5 seconds worth of data in its buffers to make sure that no matter what happens on the disk, we're always ready to go. When you use vary speed, you're moving through the buffer much faster, or sometimes much faster and sometimes much slower, which can completely change the data rate you need from disk. You zip through all the data, you've got to get a lot more in very quickly, and this obviously puts an upper limit on how fast you can scrub or do vary speed. Arranging the disk I.O. to handle that is a little tricky. Again, this is something that once you've done it once, it becomes obvious how to do it, but until you do it once or see somebody else do it once, you don't necessarily realize the issues. And in particular, what you need to do to handle that is to make sure that when you're doing disk I.O., you do not starve the lean, nice tracks just because some of them are being greedy. If you've got a whole series of tracks or buffers in your program and some of them are emptying very rapidly, you do not go in and fill them up and then move on to the next track. You basically do a fair share system where each track gets the same amount of data put into it, and then if some of them still have space, then you go back and fill them up some more. And then if they need more space, you go back again. And it turns out that doing it the other way around, where you fill up the ones that are nearly empty, completely messes up all the scheduling. And you can very rapidly cause dropouts by doing that if you're doing scrubbing on one track, for example. Another little interesting detail that took a long time to get flushed out, and once again, you know, in hindsight, it seems like, well, yeah, you know, this is obvious, but if you write the code so that you always try to do disk I.O. in these big chunks, you can very easily find yourself in a situation where the thread that does disk I.O. looks at the amount of data to be written to disk and says, well, there isn't enough. He's only got, like, you know, 234 bytes. I'm not writing that to disk. I'm going to wait till we have enough. The problem is, that was the last 234 bytes of what you were just recording. Okay? And it's not on disk at this point. And you can come up with all manner of scenarios as to how you lose it, or it never ends up on disk, or it's not where it should be on disk, various other things happen. And so there are certain situations where the big chunk rule has to be thrown away, and you have to go in and say, I don't care that there isn't a big chunk, put this on disk regardless of how much there is there. There was a bug that I think lasted 2 years in Ardour that arose from that error. It seems so obvious now. When do we do this? When do we do disk I.O.? Well, you know, the first question is, how do we get it started? And somebody has to wake up this thread. We've already said we can't do it in the audio thread, so there's another thread somewhere. When's it, how are we going to wake it up? How do we tell it, hey, dude, there's data. Please wake up, move it to disk, and then go back to sleep. Well, one obvious method, if you're using threads, is to use pthread condition signal or pthread con signal. But to use that, you need a mutex, which means you're holding a lock, which we said is no good in the audio thread because you can block. You could use a FIFO, and you could write to the other thread. You could just write a byte to a FIFO and wake it up. But going through write still means you could block in the kernel, not for very long, but you'd still block. The last solution, I didn't put on the list, but Francois reminded me of last night, is you can have the disk I/O thread just polling periodically, waking up and checking if there's disk I/O. This kind of works. The problem is you have to pick the interval that it polls at, and if the interval is too long, there are times when you want disk I/O to happen right now, and the disk thread doesn't wake up, and there are other times when you're just wasting CPU cycles, a few, by having it wake up when there's nothing to do. There aren't any particularly great solutions to how to do this right now. Yeah.
Regarding the lock with pthread condition variables, mm-hmm. I was thinking you only hold the lock when the condition changes, not while you're waiting. So is that a problem, really?
The problem is you have to take the lock in order to signal that the condition's true. Mm-hmm. And the audio thread doesn't normally hold that lock. Yes. It would have to actually acquire the lock first, mm-hmm. Signal that the condition's true, and then release the lock.
But if the mutex is only used to change the condition, no one will ever hold that mutex for any time.
They don't hold it for very much time, but they'll still hold it for enough that the audio thread might go to sleep. It'll go to sleep and wake up soon afterwards, but soon afterwards might be 100 microseconds, 800 microseconds later, mm-hmm. and if you're working at low latency settings, boom.
Yep.
It doesn't work. I mean, in practice, 99% of the time, it'll wake up in 20 microseconds.
Yes, always.
But it's easy to find situations where that's not true, and in fact, it gets delayed for enough time. And even that 20 microseconds, under some circumstances, you know, can be enough to affect how other things work. So it would be really nice to find a solution that doesn't involve doing this. I have to say, ARDA right now takes the lock. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's not real-time safe. Refilling the buffer, I talked about a little bit already, but basically, if you imagine you have a playlist, which is a specification of which chunks of various audio files should be played at what time, what the disk thread is really doing is going off and reading data from those sections of those audio files and putting them into the buffer in the right order. When we change the playlist, how do we refill the buffer? We've already said that only one thread can access each pointer. We can't just go overriding the whole buffer. But it's also very difficult for us to find out where to put the data. And the long and the short of it for now is that refilling the buffer is not atomic. And I really like a solution to this problem. Man, I'm going slowly here. Getting a handle on the controls. Most user programs with graphical interfaces or even non-graphical interfaces tend to have a single point of control, which is the user interface, whether it's ncurses or the command line or whatever else, a GUI. But most functional music software tends to require more than this. We tend to want MIDI machine control or some sort of like MIDI song position pointer or just SMPTE transport control. We want MIDI control from continuous controllers on fader boxes and stuff. We probably want automation of various parameters like gain or plugin parameters or panning. Sometimes we also want network control like OSC or the new VST link type of stuff where we've got commands being sent from one machine to another. Each time you introduce one of these controls, you have a new set of controls that operate on various parts of the program's behavior. Now, a GUI basically is something that represents the state of a program, and it also lets you control the state of the program. You press a button, you change whether we're recording. You move a fader, you change some parameter or volume or something that's happening. The GUI needs to be able to change its appearance at any time because it's meant to be telling you what is going on. What is the game level? Are we recording? Are we playing? Which track are we doing what to? And so it needs to be able to redraw various widgets on the screen or whatever at any point in time to reflect the state of the program. The problem is that the changes in the program don't only come from the GUI. In a traditional program, the only time that buttons get pressed is when you click on the button. But all you have to do is to hook up a MIDI fader box, and now the button's supposed to get pressed when you press the button on the MIDI fader box. Alternatively, you may press the button to do an operation that currently isn't allowed. You may be running Arda in a situation, for example, where you can't do capture. You go to press the record button, nothing's supposed to happen because you're not allowed to do it. You've also got all these other sources of control. You've got automation playback. You've recorded a nice gain curve, and now you want to play it back with that, and you want the fader to move up and down to show you what's going on. I don't know why you want the fader to move, but people do want the fader to move. And so now, you know, we've now got the audio thread that's reading through all this automation data and getting things ready, but now the fader needs to move up and down to reflect this automation data. Nobody's pressing any buttons, nobody's doing anything, but the fader has to move. So we have a whole new set of control information that has to be reflected in the GUI. And the problem is that most GUI toolkits that we use today don't really keep this in mind. They're really written with the assumption that what controls the state of the program is the GUI, and the GUI just reflects that. So let's talk about one of my favorite programming paradigms, model, view, controller programming. Three terms: the model, some kind of software abstraction that represents the internal state of the program. A view, which is something that presents part of the model state to the user. It's typically something you're looking at on the screen, a bunch of widgets, whatever. But you could do it with sound or speech or anything else. And a controller, which is any mechanism that's available to modify the state of the model. It could be an on-screen button, it could be a MIDI control surface, it could be a message sent via OSC, or anything else. The key thing about using this programming paradigm is that requesting a change in the state of the model, that is going from not doing anything to playing, or not being record-enabled to record-enabled, or being at 0 dB and moving down to minus 6 dB, making the request and altering the redisplay of the screen are totally separate things. That you make the request, and if the state of the model changes, then you change what shows up on the screen. When you use this model, you have to keep in mind there can be any number of controllers and any number of views. Again, most programs typically only have one view. Some particular way they represent what's going on the screen. There's no reason why you couldn't have multiple different kinds of views of the same system. One example that I don't think we ever actually tried this, but I think Jeremy Hall and I were wondering if you could actually have Arda KSI and Arda both controlling the same session at the same time. You know, have a text-based view of the system and a graphical view. So model view controller programming helps us to define an ordered relationship between the model, the views, and the controllers. And it also helps to ensure that any change that is caused by any controller will result in updates to all the relevant views. As an aside, I just want to mention here, a couple of people have mentioned this in the last day or two, but I spent 4.5 years working in the computer science department for the University of Washington. And when I was there, I looked around a lot at projects that were going on and found myself thinking, God, who is ever going to use all this stuff? This like basic research. I mean, there was this guy there, graduate student called Kevin Sullivan, who was helping the medical school design a new way of looking at X-ray and CAT scan data of patients. And he was doing it as an exercise in model view controller programming. And I remember sitting with him for hours and having him explain to me how important this was and how you had different slices through the patient and different color scheme representations, and you could go in and tweak some part of the data set or add a new piece of data and everything would update. And thinking, yeah, so what? And like many other things that were going on there, you know, 10 years down the road, here I am, explaining how wonderful it is and how we should all be using it. Back in the real world, we have a few issues to deal with. In most programs, MIDI.io is probably going to happen in something other than the GUI thread. It's going to happen because you want accurate timestamping, right? And you do it in the GUI thread, but the timestamping isn't going to happen until the GUI is finished doing whatever it's doing. So you've probably got MIDI.io happening in another thread. So if we just take the simple example of, you know, a MIDI fader box, you move the fader, something happens to the program. You've now got MIDI data arriving in one thread that has to change something in the GUI thread. We have to deal with cross-thread communication here. We need a mechanism to notify all the views, that is all the ways we represent the model on the screen, about changes. And the typical way to do this is nothing really more than an anonymous callback system. And when something happens to the model, when we move a fader, when we click on the screen, when a message arrives from outer space, or every registered callback for that, for the change that that creates, gets called, and presumably something happens. The fader moves on the screen, a button becomes illuminated, a piece of text changes somewhere. Three examples of widely used mechanisms to do this are libsig C++, which is specifically for C++, the Qt signals and slots mechanism, which was an inspiration for libsig C++, and the gobject signal system, which is extremely similar to both of these other things, even though it's implemented in C. Using any of those systems allows us to have a view that says to the model, hey, whenever this happens, please call this function. And whenever it happens, it calls the function and something changes. Whoops, hold on, I think I missed the bottom again. I should shrink the text size down. One of the benefits of using this approach to designing user interfaces and how they interact with the code. The first thing is the model doesn't know anything about the views. So the back end, the part of your code that's actually doing interesting work with DSP or whatever it's doing, doesn't have any UI code in it whatsoever, which has a number of benefits just conceptually. It also means you can add completely new user interfaces to the back end, and the back end doesn't have to change. Also, the views and the controllers don't know about each other. The view doesn't know which controllers exist. The controllers don't have any idea what views they're updating. More importantly, it's extremely scalable. You can add or remove new views, new ways of looking at states of the model, without having to modify the model at all. Because all that's happening is the model just gets another callback registered, and it changes, and something happens. But the model has no clue what. So it becomes extremely easy to add stuff. I remember being very happy the first time I had Arda's Mixer screen working at the same time as the editor, and you go in and you click on the record enable button in the editor, and the record enable button in the mixer is depressed as well. The editor has no clue that the mixer exists, and there's another window, in fact, that existed at that time which has another record enable button, and it would engage too. Now, if you imagine trying to write that without the system, every single one of those components has to know about the other one. When you press the mixer button, it has to say, hey, editor, I just did this, you need to change this. Hey, other window, please make this button change. And it's hopelessly unscalable. You can't keep adding stuff to the system without getting tangled in an enormous web of horrendous code. So I firmly believe that model view controller programming is, if not critical, extremely helpful in organizing audio software, because in the real world, most audio software that turns out to be useful, we want to hook up to other control sources than just what's on the screen. And without doing this, that can get really complicated really quickly. All right, I'm going to go over some stuff that Frank talked about yesterday, but from a slightly different angle. Positional and speed synchronization. Did I spell that right? Yeah. Why should you care about this? Well, the basic premise is that no single application or piece of equipment will do everything. If you look at all the powerful systems that exist, not only in audio, but in many other things, they're built up out of components that communicate and interact with each other. If you build an application that can't sync with other applications and or external devices, they're nearly always less useful and sometimes they're useless. There are things you want to do that you just cannot do with them. Synchronization is one example of a certain kind of glue that connects together these independent system components. If you walk into a non-computer-based studio that has an Akai MPC and it's connected up to a sound module and it's also got some sort of ADAT tape recording system, the whole thing will run quite happily, totally in sync. You can press a button on one of them and they all start playing and they all stay locked together some of the time. It's important that, you know, applications can function in the same way, and they do not think of themselves as islands that can take care of everything. Synchronization is really important in connecting them together. But there are some important things you have to understand about synchronization. One of them is the big difference between positional and speed synchronization. I'm taking these terms mostly from Pro Tools, but I like them. You have to know where does a sync signal come from, how do we chase and lock to it, and what about nonlinear motion? Kinds of synchronization. Positional synchronization tells us where are we now. And speed synchronization tells us how fast are we moving. It could be backwards too, it's direction, but it's just a minus sign. Positional sync is typically some kind of transport signal. SIMT, IDE time code, the JAC transport information that we added recently. Worth noting that MIDI timecode is SIMT. There is no difference between them. One of them is just an encoding of the other one in a different way. MIDI song position has nothing to do with MIDI timecode, and MIDI timecode has nothing to do with MIDI clock. There's a lot of confusion that floats around about what these things are. They are completely unrelated to each other. Speed synchronization is typically coming from some kind of sample clock, but you can also have tempo clocks like MIDI clock, which is also telling you how fast are we moving. The sample clock is telling you how fast are we moving through an audio stream. The MIDI clock is telling you how fast are we moving through a musical series of beats or bars. Notice that the sample clocks and the tempo clocks are both giving you speed synchronization. But in the other big difference is that the word clock is using just free running time. It starts and it just runs. Nobody's telling you, we are here, here, and here. It'll just keep running. The MIDI clock, however, has to be based on user information. You go in and you say the tempo at the beginning is 120 beats per minute, and that continues for 5 bars, and then we shift to 110 beats per minute, and the time signature changes. And so the MIDI clock is not an absolute external information source. The application can view it that way, but it's based on information that is provided by the user. All right, go ahead and confuse them. Because sometimes you have to use positional sync for speed. If you're receiving a SIMT signal, it's really trying to tell you where you are. It's not telling you a speed at all. But you have to infer the speed you're moving at from looking at the time code. And this actually turns out to be quite tricky to do, basically. Now, it's quite tricky to do. The basic model is really, can be quite simple. You just look at where you were last time, compare it to where you are now, figure out how long it is in between, and then you know how fast you're moving. And you reset the speed, and presumably the right thing happens. This does track the current speed. The problem is that it'll change significantly each time you compute this. It may change significantly each time you compute this, which sounds terrible, because the speed just keeps shifting back and forth. So you really need to add a little bit of hysteresis. And also, the other thing I want to note is that doesn't keep up with where you are. That keeps resetting what the speed is, but it doesn't actually make sure you're in the right place. So we can fix the fact that it jumps around a lot by just adding some hysteresis, which is we add in some amount of the last speed, and we also mix in some of the new speed, and so now it changes more slowly. And this actually works quite nicely, except you have to choose the constants in here that you can't really read, X and Y. You have to choose them very carefully, and if you get them wrong, it sounds terrible, and if you get them right, it's too subtle. You still have to find some way of going and looking and saying, okay, we now know how fast we're moving or how fast we should be moving, but we also got to make sure we're in the right position too. If we drifted out of speed, we got to get back to the right place, which unfortunately is also not particularly easy. Two terminology points here, chase and lock. Chase, at least the way I understand it, is basically where the device that's doing the chasing is receiving a positional synchronization signal. It jumps to a position and then tries to follow from wherever it's jumped to and stay locked in it. If it manages to do that is, if it can move at the same speed and stay locked in it and stay with the position, then we say that it's locked. How to lock, though? Frank mentioned phase lock loops yesterday, and they are, as I think he mentioned, sort of a classic EE technique, but they seem to be opaque to most programmers, including myself. I think I understand what they are, but I'm not really sure. I think they might be really, really simple, but it's kind of like one of those terms that you're just not sure whether it's hiding something really important that you don't get. However, even when you have a phase lock loop, there's nearly always these constants and various other things in it that affect how it works. And if you don't get them right, it doesn't work very well either. As a result, handling the situations where things go wrong tends to be hard. It's quite easy to use a phase lock loop to track things when everything's just moving along, the tape or whatever it is providing transport information is moving nice and smoothly, and we just move along with it. But then suddenly something happens, like we jump to a different place, and that's hard and tends to be very, very domain specific. It's not a phase lock loop issue, it's outside of the phase lock loop. So what happens when we get nonlinear motion, which is we look at the current transport position that we're receiving from time code, and we're not where we think we ought to be. We're moving along at 30 frames or 24 frames per second, all of a sudden we find that we've gone backwards 2 minutes. What are we supposed to do? If you've got everything in memory, like, say, sweep, it's no problem. You're in memory, you just move the read pointer and keep going. But for apps that do disk I.O., you have a problem, which is that doing the jump back or forward takes time because disk I.O. takes time. And worse than that, if the disk I.O. takes long enough and what the user's doing is crazy enough, you may have to do it again even before you finished with the first set of disk I.O. An example one would be if the user is shuttling with a data wheel, and you look at it and you say, oh man, we're really jumping back here. So you move back and you try to get the data to do whatever's going to happen next. Oh, well, but he's not finished. And he keeps going. And then he goes the other way and the other way. And so, you know, and all your disk access lights are flashing and crazy. So this becomes much easier for the most common case of nonlinear motion, which is looping. When you loop, the user has in fact set loop points, and if you can communicate them to the program, you can just set things up so that the disk I.O. happens exactly the way it's supposed to happen, which is that when it hits the loop point, that the disk thread is going to read the data from back at the beginning and we'll just loop through. But the general problem of how to handle nonlinear motion is hard. It's a hard problem for people writing VST plugins. There has been lots of discussion in the last 6 months on the VST plugins list of how to do this. No good solutions. Nobody really seems to have a good handle on how to get things synced when this nonlinear motion happens. It's possible there isn't a really good solution. It's a situation that has not happened in the studio very much, because historically the situations where there were lots of devices synchronized together, they've been tape devices. And locating is so slow that nobody expects this to work like that. Now we're starting, and then again, in situations where you really just have a digital audio workstation, it might sync to one other device, which is possibly a digital device as well. It may be a digital device that doesn't do I.O. It may be a mixing console, for example. And there's only one thing to sync, and it doesn't take any time to sync, and so things are fine. It may just be that we can't really solve this problem particularly well. I hope we can find some solutions, but I think most of them are going to turn out to be problematic. I'm going to try to skip quickly through the last part because I know I have a little extra time, but I don't want to go too long. Being a time code master, wouldn't we all love to be a time? No, I wouldn't want to be a time code master. MIDI time code. You need to send 4 2-byte messages per SMPTE frame, typically 24 or 30 SMPTE frames per second, depending on which continent you live on. At 30 frames per second, that's 2 bytes every 8.33 milliseconds, which is about 7.68% of MIDI bandwidth. So there's not a lot of data in MIDI terms, but scheduling them is very hard because SMPTE frames, the interval we have to send these messages at, does not correspond to any of the timing intervals that we get from an audio interface. It doesn't correspond to any of the timing we can get from the system timer or from the real-time clock. If these messages are not delivered on time, my experience has been that other devices will chase the time code you emit, but they won't lock to it. They will see it and move, but they will be looking at it saying, who the hell is sending this? He sends a burst of messages, and then there's a gap, and then we get another bunch of them, and then there's another gap, and then there's a small gap, and then he sends a few, and they decide that whoever is sending the time code is clearly confused and they shouldn't lock. And with some devices, you actually can't get them to go into record mode when you're emitting time code that is bursty the way it is if you base it on any of the available timers that we have. So this is sort of a big problem. One solution is to forget MIDI time code and use SMPTE, which is much easier to emit. It's a continuous audio signal. It's low bandwidth. I haven't yet actually found code that will generate it, but I keep believing that there actually is some out there somewhere, and if not, I guess I'm just going to have to write it. You still have a little bit of a problem. You have to figure out which channel you intend to send it on because it's going to soak up one of your audio channels. And in some situations, that's not okay. But I think in most situations where this stuff matters, you've got multi-channel sound cards, you can probably spare one channel for a SMPTE signal. However, fortunately, well, that's actually just, this is a general comment on handling MIDI correctly. MIDI is a non-streaming protocol. We don't send a constant number of bytes per second. It uses a synchronous wire, it is a synchronous wire protocol. And we can only at most get about 1 byte every third of a millisecond down the wire. Audio, by contrast, is streaming. We send a constant number of bytes every unit of time. It's nothing more than just an abstract memory access protocol. We have no access from the computer as to how you actually get a signal onto the wire that comes out the back. So we don't have to care about wire protocols in any way. And we typically are moving hundreds to thousands of bytes per millisecond. Correct MIDI timing, to do it really correctly, means you need a third of a millisecond resolution. And I define correct meaning that a MIDI message that was received at a given transport position, when you move back to that transport position, that MIDI message should be back on the wire at that point in time. I think Frank called this sample accurate emission yesterday. We can't do MIDI I.O. from the audio thread because we get blocking issues on MIDI I.O. and stuff. We can't do it from the GUI thread because the GUI operations will block MIDI I.O. We could schedule it in user space or in the kernel, but neither of these locations have access to a good timer. The standard kernel time is no good, the real-time clock is no good, and the audio interrupt stream is no good. So we fundamentally don't have any way of doing this correctly. And we have a bunch of programs that do it now, and it sounds okay because generally we're not doing that much synchronization in our systems. Most people have a single machine, emits MIDI, it's subject to a relatively constant delay in the way that things are emitted, and it kind of sounds all right. But if you start syncing up with other systems that do have hardware timing for MIDI, you start realizing that it doesn't work correctly on Linux at all. However, fortunately, those wily kernel hackers have come to our rescue, because in 2.5, we have new POSIX clock support. All this really means is accurate timing, more than anything else. And what happens in 2.5 is that rather than rely on a single static timer that goes off every millisecond or every 10 milliseconds or whatever, we actually reprogram the PC hardware to interrupt us in a certain number of microseconds. And this is now in the 2.5 kernel. Linus was actually very lukewarm about this up until a month ago. He was still not very happy about the patch or adding it, and all of a sudden it went in, which I think is sort of the way he does things a lot. It's great. I mean, to be honest, this is just going to, it will revolutionize MIDI and synchronization in general on Linux, because we get rid of any reliance on the kernel Hertz value. We don't have to care about what the system timer is like at all. We want something to happen in 300 microseconds. If we have SCED FIFO scheduling, it's going to happen. It leads to a very simple solution for handling MIDI I/O. You've got one thread sleeping in poll on input. It reads the input, parses it, and delivers it to wherever it's going. And you have another thread which sleeps until the next MIDI event has to happen, and then it hands it to the device driver. And then other threads that need to line up MIDI just queue it with the output thread. So a little bit more complicated than this loop, but not much. This obviously gives rise to the question of, you know, this is doing what the ALSA sequence is doing. Why don't we get the whole ALSA sequence into user space? And that was brought up yesterday, and I'm sure there'll be more discussions about it online. Hey, I'm at the end. All right, I'll just let you read this. The first four. So there are a lot of details to get right when you write these programs. You know, it's very easy to write a little sample playback engine. It's fairly easy to write, you know, something that plays MIDI files back out through your MIDI port. You start getting into doing the kinds of things that everybody points to and says, well, it's really cool how on Sonar I can hook this up and then do this, and this happens. And you start realizing, oh God, yeah, how do you do that? And how do I get that right? And what happens when this happens? You can ignore them if you want to when you start writing an application. I certainly ignored most of them when I started writing Ardour. But if the program you're working on is successful, I would pretty much guarantee that they'll eventually come back and bite you. These are not things that we invented in the Linux audio community, and they're not even necessarily things that were invented in the audio software community. They're things that audio environments expect to work right, and their behavior that the users of this stuff expect to work right. And if you don't add them, then your program's incomplete, and if you add them and they don't work correctly, then your program is close to useless. So it's a lot of work, and it's hard, but as I said at the end, it does offer you the chance to release early and often with bug fixes and so forth. And I think, oh no, that was it, because there's no plus. And I think that's it. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. We got like about 7 more minutes for a few questions from the audience. Here's the first one, Andrea.
Have you ever tried to use some real-time interfaces like RTA or RT Linux for achieving real-time performances instead of relying on the stock kernel, which is not real-time? No matter how hard you try to make it real-time,
sure,
but it's not real-time.
I haven't ever personally tried it. Victor Novasky, the primary author of RT Linux, keeps on encouraging me to use RT Linux. And he claims it has gotten dramatically easier than it used to be. One big reason for not doing it is you'd have to port all of ALSA into RT Linux. And Victor told me sometime before Christmas that that's actually not true anymore. They have a mechanism now where RT Linux can basically act as the interrupt source for ALSA. And sort of just pass the interrupts through to ALSA, so you leave them running in the Linux kernel and do everything else. I think it would have a number of really beneficial qualities. I think this whole issue of interrupts being blocked and the timing, you know, failing at low latencies would go away. But it also has this downside that, you know, one of the things that I think many of us are trying to do is to write software that people can install on reasonably standard distributions, or at least distributions that maybe they download and then they add stuff from Planet Karma, or eventually they run Agnula. And RT Linux just ends up being a whole different ballgame. You know, I think that for some applications and for building, you know, dedicated system boxes, it may have a lot of appeal to it. But I know I certainly don't have the time to even download RT Linux, let alone investigate how to hack ALSA so that the interrupts come from RT Linux. I think it's a great idea, and if somebody has the time and wants to go investigate it, it would be a great service to all of us. But I know I don't have the time.
Next one.
Regarding your model view controller abstraction, I think it's just what we need. Isn't that very close to client-server model, in the sense that the model is the server and all the rest controllers, views, are clients of it?
It's somewhat similar to it, although I think it operates at a different level of abstraction. And I think that the anonymity aspect of it is really important. You can write things that look like a client-server system, but where the client and the server both know about each other.
Yep.
And the whole beauty of the MVC, the whole beauty of the MVC abstraction is nobody really knows about anybody else.
The server needs to know about the clients. That's right. But the clients don't need to know about each other.
True.
Yeah. I think in that sense it's the same. Mm-hmm. Model, really.
I want to stress, by the way, I mean, I hope it's obvious. I think people in here are probably familiar with the terminology. MVC programming is absolutely not my idea. It's been an idea that's been floating around in the programming world for at least the last 10 years or so. It has just been, I think, very slow to be picked up by programmers in general. It does add a certain level of discipline to your coding to have to adhere to it all the time.
And for some types of systems like this ones, it's the only solution, I think. Yep.
Well, the next one up here.
So this is a little programming question for ring buffers.
Mm-hmm.
Can I rely on, if I use a C compiler, that he does it in the right order, or does I have to program it in machine code?
No, you can do it in C. The whole beauty of the code is that it doesn't rely on timing. The only thing it relies on is the monotonic movement of the pointers. As long as the pointers never move backwards, it works.
I think you have to fill first the buffer and then increment, for example, the pointer. I think that's critical. Maybe the
absolutely. I mean, you can't update the pointer before you've actually got data inside it.
But, yeah, and but you have experience, for example, with compilers which risk move instructions.
Well, you would be moving instructions, but the point is, as long as you do the pointer update after you've moved data into the buffer, you have loaded a lot of data into the buffer normally. This is not a design that you use as is for like a single byte FIFO. You've typically dumped in, you know, kilobytes of data into the buffer. You then update the pointer. Yes, it's possible there's a reordering of the last few instructions, but the honest truth is that isn't going to affect how the buffer is used, because there's now a kilobyte or kilobytes of data to read from the buffer before you get to the end of it. And so even if those last few instructions were reordered by the processor, it won't affect how it gets used.
And see, if you just make everything volatile, it shouldn't happen. Yeah.
That's also true, yeah.
Okay, more questions up here. This is Fernando from Planet Karma.
Just a remark more than a question. At the beginning, regarding root access and capabilities, while it is perfectly reasonable to expect a home user to just run as root, it doesn't work in a situation like the one I have, where you have multiple workstations with multiple users. So capabilities are a requirement. Just that. It would be. Do you know anything about file system capabilities, if they're being worked on or anything?
Probably no more than you. I mean, there does seem to be some work going on it, but...
Because that would be a much better...
Do you mean this is where you'd encode the required capabilities into the executable
I/O? Yeah, you flag a program as having some capabilities.
As I said, I personally feel that... I certainly think root access is not the right model. I think that I agree with you, the capabilities are the way to go, but the issue is that right now you have to have some capabilities in order to get SCED, FIFO, and MLOC all. And I think that the real question is should they, for our purposes at least, is it right that they're protected in that way? Because the honest truth is, for an awful lot of audio and MIDI software, every piece of software needs it. And Linux is treating those two things as though they're the preserve of some particularly unusual software, which is true, but we have a whole room full of people here that are all interested in this unusual software. So I as I say, sometimes I think maybe a kernel patch that just strips away all of the checks on whether you can do those things.
That might not be a
would
bad idea.
Really help. Yeah. I mean.
Another comment from Kai Wimanen.
Yeah, adding to that, one option would be to like make a patch that added proc entry. So I think that would be one way to get it to the standard kernel. Mm-hmm. So they won't release a kernel that has capabilities by default, but we might manage to get a proc entry.
So you could turn off the checks. Yeah,
so
that's
then
true.
You could have a standard kernel, and you'd have to write something to proc in the scripts, and then check would work mm-hmm. as non-root. That's a idea that we came up with yesterday. So,
okay, more questions? Oh, there is Johan with maybe a question from outside. Good morning to the US.
It's not really a question, but I was asked to give you all the greetings from the fellows on IRC, and I was to tell Paul that they tremendously enjoyed your presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so I think at this point we'll stop this session. Once again, Paul, thank you very much. Very informative.